Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for February Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, RCVS European and American recognized specialist in veterinary cardiology, Nuala Summerfield. Thank you, Nuala. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, and hello to everyone that's joining us today. Today we're going to talk about canine dilated cardiomyopathy, or DCM, and the clinical approach and some new perspectives. So prevalence data for canine DCM is being gathered for many breeds, and this is really important because many breeds that suffer with DCM will have different prognoses as the disease is quite breed specific in terms of how quickly it develops and how aggressive it is and the associated prognosis. So we know that in terms of the lifetime prevalence of DCM in the Doberman, which is one of the most highly predisposed breeds, the prevalence is somewhere between a quarter and a half of all dogs or all Dobermans will develop DCM during their lifetime. And obviously the prevalence in this breed increases with age. So as they get older, that prevalence will increase from about a quarter to about a half of all older Dobermans. In the Boxer, again, a highly predisposed breed with a lifetime prevalence of probably greater than 50%. In the Irish Wolfhound and the Great Dane, still again highly predisposed breeds with a lifetime prevalence of about a third or just over a third of all of these breeds or these specific dogs of these breeds developing DCM in their lifetime. So it's important to think about DCM and how it differs from some of the other more common heart diseases that we see, such as myxomatous mitral valve disease. So DCM is a primary heart muscle disease or a myocardial disease, and it's the second most common acquired cardiovascular disease. So what I mean by acquired is it's not present on echocardiography at birth. It develops over the lifetime of the dog. And it's different from myxomatous mitral valve disease as MVD or mitral valve disease is a primary valve disease, whereas DCM is a primary heart muscle disease. And that will be important when we're looking at how to diagnose this disease later on in the talk. There are two distinct phases of DCM. So we have the asymptomatic phase or preclinical phase, and this can last for several years. It's difficult to detect on physical exam, and this is because unlike myxomatous mitral valve disease, which is easy to detect because a heart murmur of mitral regurgitation develops, if you imagine listening to a dog's heart and the underlying problem is that the heart muscle is dilating and losing its ability to contract as vigorously, that may have no abnormalities that you could hear with a stethoscope. So that's why when you do a physical examination in the preclinical stage, so before the animal is showing any symptoms, you may not pick up anything on your auscultation or your palpation of pulses or your mucous membrane color or your respiratory rate or heart rate. Now, the symptomatic stage of the disease is a shorter phase. Depending on how aggressive the disease is in a particular dog or breed, this may last for several weeks to a number of months, but it's a shorter phase than the asymptomatic phase, and it carries a poor prognosis once symptoms develop, and these symptoms are going to be typically congestive heart failure. So first symptom of overt or of symptomatic or clinical DCM will be overt heart failure. But do remember, in some breeds, the first symptom may actually be sudden cardiac death. This is something we see in the Dobermans and also in the Great Danes. It's emerging more in that breed as well, that the first symptom an owner may have or may see that the dog had underlying heart disease is it drops dead, and this is typically on exercise, so for example on a walk. There's definitely breed variability in the rate of progression of DCM, and as we said before, we see certain breeds that are highly predisposed And of those breeds, the Doberman and the Great Dane would have a typically much more aggressive, progressive form of the disease. And it typically is more slowly progressive in, for example, the Cocker Spaniel, Irish Wolfhound, Newfoundland. A key thing to remember is that the symptomatic phase that we see when those dogs are showing congestive heart failure signs, so difficulty breathing, exercise intolerance, these really are just the tip of the iceberg. It's really important to remember that the preclinical or asymptomatic phase of the disease is what we typically see with an iceberg, but or what we don't see with an iceberg below the water, is a much larger or longer phase of the disease. Very, very important to be thinking about this phase of the disease as we now consider how best to manage and treat dogs with dilated cardiomyopathy. Historically, we were really just treating in the symptomatic phase of the disease, and now we're able to consider the pre-symptomatic or preclinical phase. And this is particularly important since the publication of the PROTECT study, which we'll talk about a bit later. This study has really shifted focus to this asymptomatic or preclinical phase of dilated cardiomyopathy, which is really where we can have a big impact in terms of diagnosis and treatment. So early diagnosis of dilated cardiomyopathy provides a really valuable opportunity to us as vets to confirm the diagnosis, stage how far in that asymptomatic phase the disease is, and discuss whether treatment is indicated. So for example, if it's a Doberman, does the dog meet the PROTECT study criteria, and therefore would the dog benefit from starting on therapy in this asymptomatic phase? And again, we'll talk more in detail about the PROTECT study and those results and what they mean a bit later in the talk. And so the key thing here is thinking about early diagnosis before clinical signs of congestive heart failure develop. But remember that these animals are asymptomatic, so according to their owners, they seem completely normal. And therefore, it's going to require a conscious effort by us vets to really look for the disease, because these animals have no outward symptoms. And so this is what we mean by cardiac screening. So we're actually actively looking for a condition in a population that seem outwardly healthy, but which we have identified that there are breed risks or other high indexes of suspicion that make us concerned these animals could be the ones that are going to develop DCM, and we want to catch them in that preclinical phase. So what types of things would increase our index of suspicion that a dog might have preclinical or early DCM? Well, remember that dilated cardiomyopathy is an acquired, so adult onset disease. So therefore, if we're screening dogs that seem asymptomatic, we want to screen adult dogs, because if we're screening puppies, we won't see it. The genetics, which most of these conditions, these DCM conditions that we see in various breeds, are likely to have a genetic basis. And that genetic basis is likely to be different between the different breeds. But we don't understand the genetics enough yet to enable us to do genetic screening in puppies. So therefore, we would be screening these dogs with ultrasound and various other screening methods that we'll talk about later on. And so in a puppy, we just won't see any evidence of the DCM phenotype. So therefore, if we're going to use the screening tools that we have available, we need to wait till these dogs are adults. So therefore, we're going to screen dogs greater than 3 years old. We know that it's a disease that typically affects large and giant breed dogs. Yes, the Cocker Spaniel is an exception to this, but on the whole, it's a disease of dogs greater than 20 kilos. And so this is in contrast to Myxomatous mitral valve disease, which we typically think of in middle age and older small breed dogs. So that's where these two acquired heart diseases affect dogs at sort of either end of the weight spectrum. So when we think of middle aged to older, larger dogs, it's going to be dilated cardiomyopathy, which is predominantly the disease that we're more likely to come across. So we're going to screen adult larger dogs, and then we're going to think about those dogs who have an increased breed predisposition, so therefore they are at risk breeds. And those, as we mentioned before, will definitely be the Doberman, the Great Dane, the Wolfhound, but also the Cocker Spaniel. We see this in breeds such as the Dog de Bordeaux, other Mastiff breeds, Newfoundland, Boxer. So there are a number of breeds that have an increased predisposition to developing dilated cardiomyopathy. And then another factor that would increase our index of suspicion would be if there was a known family history of DCM, and that's, as I mentioned earlier, because we're strongly suspicious that there's a genetic or heritable component to this condition. But it's just not fully understood. It's not a straightforward genetics inheritance sort of pattern that we're seeing. It's likely to be both a combination of one or several genes and effects of the environment, but certainly because of the genetic component, if there's a family member, whether it be a sibling or a parent or a grandparent, that's known to have had DCM, particularly in these very at-risk breeds, that should definitely be taken into account and would increase our index of suspicion. So if you're potentially seeing dogs from breeders, this would be a very important thing to be asking. So as we said for screening, physical examination is certainly where we would typically start, but detecting preclinical dilated cardiomyopathy on physical examination alone can be challenging because these dogs have no outward symptoms, so we're not expecting to see any physical findings suggestive of decreased cardiac output or sort of congestive heart failure. These hearts are still able to function and the dogs are still able to exercise normally, or at least normally compared according to their owners. So we're really looking for subtle things on that physical examination, which again is in contrast to dogs with mitral valve disease, which will have a mitral murmur from the beginning or from the point that their mitral valve starts leaking. It may be a very soft murmur that's more difficult to hear initially, and then that murmur gets louder over time as the leak increases. But what that does mean is that detecting primary valvular disease is much easier than detecting primary heart muscle disease from a physical examination alone. So remember with dilated cardiomyopathy that yes, some of these dogs will have a heart murmur that you'll pick up, but not all of them. And so again, that's in contrast to myxomatous mitral valve disease, whereas if your dog has mitral valve disease as an acquired heart disease associated with age, then they will have a heart murmur. Whereas in dilated cardiomyopathy, probably only about half of these dogs will have an audible heart murmur. So if we pick it up, that can be very helpful in alerting us that something's going on. But that murmur is typically not due to myxomatous or degenerative age-related changes of the mitral valve. It's typically related to the fact that as that heart is stretching and dilating, the annulus or the hinge points of the mitral valve get pulled apart. And as a result, the mitral valve doesn't close properly. And I'll show you some echocardiographic images to make that clearer later on. But because the mitral valve isn't closing properly, then a small leak can develop through the middle of the mitral valve. And so that's typically associated with a softer murmur, so a grade 1 to 3 out of 6 systolic left apical mitral murmur. You may detect an arrhythmia in these dogs, or a gallop sound, or an irregular pulse. So the irregular pulse would be associated with the, or typically with an arrhythmia. So if you have a premature contraction, you may have a pulse deficit that you detect if you're listening to the heart and feeling the pulses at the same time, which is a very good sort of habit to get into, because that does enable you to pick up pulse deficits and associate that with what you hear on the heart rhythm. So if you hear a gallop sound, that's that triple cadence or third sound, and that may suggest that the heart muscle has poor relaxation ability, and that can cause that third heart sound. So any abnormalities to rhythm or a triple cadence that you hear in a middle-aged to older large breed dog definitely is significant, even if it's just a very occasional arrhythmia. Definitely don't overlook that, because that may be very significant, as we'll see later on. But then, even if the physical exam is completely normal, if your index of suspicion remains high, it's definitely warranted to continue with further screening tests. So heart ultrasound or echocardiography is the gold standard screening method for dilated cardiomyopathy. It's useful because we can use echo to exclude other types of acquired and congenital heart diseases that could confuse the picture and result in enlargement of the left side of the heart or decreases in systolic function. So we do need ultrasound to definitively diagnose that this is dilated cardiomyopathy. When assessing heart chamber sizes, these can be referenced to the body weight of the dog if normal values for the breed have not been published. So as we'll see with thoracic radiographs as well, what we're seeing now is that different breeds have different sizes of hearts as their sort of baseline normals. So certain breeds just normally have bigger hearts than others, and that doesn't mean that they have disease, but it's really important for us to know that when we're assessing their hearts, either on radiographs or on echo. And that's why if there are any breed reference values available for heart size on echo and heart size on thoracic radiograph, so your VHS or vertebral heart scale, then it's really preferable to use those. If you can't find breed reference ranges, then what we can do is actually index the measurements to body weight. And what that does is, if you think about our patient size in dogs, we have such a dramatic difference in breeds and phenotypes of dogs, you know, from tiny dogs that weigh a few kilos to, you know, huge giant breeds that weigh 80 kilos. And therefore, by referencing the ultrasound images and the chamber sizes that we measure to their body weight, it's a very accurate way of scaling to see whether the heart sizes are within reference ranges or not. And ultrasound is certainly the preferred method in the dog for diagnosing dilated cardiomyopathy. And in the Doberman in particular, as a breed, there's been a lot of work looking at how best on ultrasound to diagnose asymptomatic or early stage dilated cardiomyopathy. And there's a very interesting paper that if this is an area that interests you, is definitely worth reading. I've put the reference there. It's a European Society of Veterinary Cardiology screening guidelines for DCM in Dobermans. And this is a recent paper, and they basically go through, as you, if you had a Doberman patient that presented to you, what the screening criteria are for normal and abnormal for all the screening tests that we do. So for ultrasound, thoracic radiographs, ECG, biomarkers, Holter, etc. And we'll go through some of those in this talk, but definitely a reference worth reading if it's an area that you're interested in. And so from that paper, one of the take-home points was that for the Doberman, when we're assessing the size or the volume of the left ventricle, the most accurate or preferred method to do this that has the best sort of chance of picking up early dilated cardiomyopathy is something called Simpson's method of discs. And that paper nicely describes how to do that and sort of what that volumetric calculation or measurement looks like. So what we'll do is we'll have a look here at a dog with a normal heart on ultrasound. And some of you may be quite familiar with doing cardiac ultrasound in dogs, others not. This is a large breed dog, and often larger breed dogs can have hearts that don't look quite as vigorous as some of the smaller breeds that we see. But this dog had a normal heart, and what we can see here, this is the left atrium. So this is a right parasternal four-chamber long axis view. And if I point here, this is the left atrium, right atrium, and then you have the interatrial septum, then we have the interventricular septum, and then in the near field you've got the right ventricle, and here we have the left ventricle, and here's the left ventricular free wall. And here we have the mitral valve, and up here we have the tricuspid valve. So what we're doing here is we're looking at the heart in long axis from the right side of the imaging is from the right side of the chest, and we're assessing the left ventricular contraction, the movement of the mitral valve, the size of the left atrium. And so when I show you the next image, which is a dog with dilated cardiomyopathy or in the presymptomatic or asymptomatic phase, just try now to sort of put in your mind how this heart is contracting, and then we'll look at the next image. And if we look at this video here, this dog has asymptomatic dilated cardiomyopathy, but if you look at the left ventricular shape, see how it's much more rounded. So you've got apical rounding here. The left atrium's larger than on the previous case. You don't get as good a view of the right heart. In many breeds, DCM affects the left side of the heart. Some breeds, we do see right heart enlargement too. So in that case, you would also, in the near field, because obviously we're imaging from the right side, you might see right ventricular chamber enlargement and right atrial enlargement. But in this dog, it's predominantly left atrial and left ventricular chamber enlargement. But the key thing here is to just look at this heart muscle and see how weakly it's contracting. And a lot of this movement is actually probably panting from the dog's and the chest movements or excursions, but there's very little systolic function or contraction actually, you know, squeezing this blood out of the chamber. And so also when we talk about the mitral murmur, and the reason for that is because these are the hinge points here and here of the mitral valve. So as this heart stretches, then the tips of the mitral valve may not meet as effectively or seal as well as they did before, and so a small leak can develop through the middle of the mitral valve. But it's not because the mitral valve itself has degenerated or become thickened, like in myxomatous mitral valve disease. It's more frequently due to the fact that the valve is just being stretched. But again, look at this chamber size or the chamber volume, and there's not really a lot of change between systole and diastole. Amazingly, this dog had no outward symptoms. The owner still felt the dog was exercising well. And on clinical examination in the consult room, this dog had a normal heart rate, a resting sinus arrhythmia, good pulses, good color. So it just goes to show that the heart has an incredible ability to compensate and cope and still maintain cardiac output and perfusion really until it's very compromised. And that's why often these dogs then go crashing into heart failure, because the heart has coped for so long that then there's very little cardiac reserve left. And that's why I want to catch them in this phase. Ideally earlier than this, this dog's heart has already increased significantly in size. And if we can catch them earlier, even in the asymptomatic phase, then we have a really good opportunity to intervene with therapy and try to slow progression of the disease. And so if we look at the next image, this is a right parasternal short axis view through the left ventricle. So it's exactly the same heart that we've just looked at, but now we're cutting it in short axis rather than looking at it in long axis. And so what we have here is the interventricular septum, left ventricular chamber, left ventricular free wall. This is one of the papillary muscles here. And you can see a little cordy tendon just attached to the papillary muscle. So it's part of the mitral valve apparatus. We're just below the mitral valve at the moment. The right heart is here, wrapping around in a sort of crescent shape around the left heart. And the key things, again, to notice are the fact that the heart muscle is really not doing very much. So if you look at the volume of this chamber, it's a very dilated heart, sort of very round globoid shape of the left ventricle. But look at the heart muscle movement, it's not actually contracting vigorously. And so the actual volume in that left ventricular chamber is not really changing significantly between systole and diastole. Another way that we frequently assess systolic function or the ability of the heart muscle fibers to shorten when they contract is using fractional shortening. And fractional shortening is a crude method. It's not the most accurate method. As we talked about a few slides ago, the Simpson's method of discs, which is a volumetric method, is much more accurate to really look at how well the ventricle is able to eject blood and the true systolic function, but it's a little bit more technically difficult to obtain those measurements. I mean, to be fair, once you've done it a few times, it's pretty straightforward. But if you haven't done much cardiac ultrasound, it would just take a little bit of practice to learn, you know, how do you make those measurements on your machine, what kind of views, really optimizing your long axis view to get a very good Simpson's methods of disc calculation. A very straightforward way is to do the fractional shortening, and we typically will measure this from an M mode. So the reason why this is not as accurate is it's a one-dimensional assessment. So we have the image I just showed you that was moving, so a right parasternal short axis view through the left ventricle. And I've labeled the left ventricle there on the right of the screen for you. And we drop a single cursor through the middle of the left ventricle to obtain a one-dimensional plane. And then we're looking at the structures as they basically move along that one-dimensional cursor. So here's our M-mode cursor. And what we're wanting to do is to look at the interventricular septum, the left ventricular lumen, and the left ventricular free wall as they move over time. So basically an M mode, if I look on the left of the screen here, is a graph essentially of depth over time. And what we're looking at here is this would be the interventricular septum as it relaxes, contracts. This is the left ventricular free wall as it contracts, relaxes. And this is the left ventricular lumen as it expands in diastole and fills, and then as it ejects blood and becomes smaller in volume in systole. And what we can see here in this dog with dilated cardiomyopathy is that there's very little movement. A lot of this, again, is panting, because if you're looking at the actual thickness of the walls, it's not really changing between systole, when the wall should be contracting, and diastole when it's relaxing. A lot of this movement is undulation, most likely related to the dog panting, or chest excursions. Same with the free wall. Maybe there's a little bit more thickening in systole than in diastole, but not very much compared to a normal dog. And the left ventricular internal dimension in diastole compared to the left ventricular internal dimension in systole, again, there's not a big difference between the two. Now, the way that we calculate a fractional shortening is we measure the left ventricular internal diameter in diastole and subtract the left ventricular internal dimension in systole divided by the diastolic dimension times 100, and that gives you a percentage, which is fractional shortening. And in most large breed, giant breed dogs, a normal would be sort of mid to high 20s, so 25 to 28, up to about 40%. And true dilated cardiomyopathies, probably consistently below around sort of 15 to 18%. And some of these dogs we're seeing, you know, 5, 6, 7%, you know, it's very, very low. So it's a cruder, but it is one way to assess systolic function on your ultrasound, particularly if you've done less ultrasound. The key thing is really to get a nice symmetric left ventricular short axis view, so it's nice and circular, and to make sure that your M-mode line transects right down the middle of it. Now, this right parasternal long axis four-chamber view that we looked at before, I showed you a moving image. Again, I just wanted to point out about the mitral regurgitation. So again, we've got left atrium, left ventricle, mitral valve, and the reason we get mitral regurgitation is if these hinge points have been pulled significantly apart, that the tips of the mitral valve don't meet in the middle well as they did, and so we get a small leak typically developing through the middle of the valve. Because the left ventricle, the muscle, is weakened because it's starting to lose its ability to contract vigorously, the actual driving force or pressure that the ventricle is able to generate is lower than normal. And again, that means there's less of a driving force behind the mitral regurgitant leak, which is another reason why the murmurs tend to be softer, so typically a grade sort of 1 to 3. Interestingly, this dog is a little different from the ones I showed you before, in that you see in the near field there is actually some evidence of right ventricular and right atrial enlargement. So this particular dog has biventricular or generalized cardiac enlargement, whereas in some breeds it's really just specifically left-sided enlargement that we see. And this image is a what we call a left apical four-chamber view, and this is taken from the left side. It's a more difficult image to obtain, so probably something that when you're starting off doing ultrasound you may find a bit challenging, but it comes with practice and is a useful view to be able to assess leakage through the mitral and tricuspid valve. So on the left of the screen, you can see the heart is upside down and the atria are at the bottom and the ventricles are at the top, and the left side of the heart is on the right side of the screen and vice versa. And sadly, ultrasounds don't come labeled like this, but with the labeling, hopefully this makes it clear what's where. So we have the left ventricular chamber here, mitral valve is here, left atrium is here, and then you've got the interatrial septum, right atrium, tricuspid valve, right ventricle, interventricular septum, left ventricular apex would be up at the top of the heart, up here. Now, if we use something called color flow Doppler, this is a way that we can look for turbulent blood flow, so leakage across blood, across valves, for example, using this color flow Doppler modality. So if we place the color flow over this image that you've just seen here, and here on the right of the screen you can see that we've done that, what you can see is across the mitral valve we can see this sort of turquoise jet in here. Okay, there's a small turquoise jet. Yes, there's a lot of other blood flow in the background, so this red flow, and there's a tiny bit of blue flow above, but the key thing I want you to see here is this sort of turquoise yellow small jet. That's a jet of mitral regurgitation. That's turbulent blood flow. And on the right side, again, we've got a little turquoise yellow turbulent jet here of tricuspid regurgitation coming through the tricuspid valve. So both of these leakages will be causing soft murmurs, and they're associated with the valve annuli or annulus on either side being pulled apart, and so we get a small central leak. So clearly ultrasound of the heart is a really good, accurate way of looking for asymptomatic or early DCM before we've got clinical signs. But it's probably not practical to do echo on every dog that we suspect to have early DCM as a screening tool. And there are a number of reasons for this. One is clearly cost constraints. Ultrasound is a more expensive test than some of the other tests we have available, but also ultrasound is very operator dependent, and so it's going to be dependent on the local availability of an ultrasound machine that has cardiac capabilities, and not all practices will have an ultrasound machine that can do cardiac scanning, but also the expertise of the operator. You know, how familiar is the person with doing cardiac ultrasound. And so there are several other screening tests that it's important to be aware of that can be useful to identify dogs that could be suffering from asymptomatic DCM. And the purpose of using these additional screening tests is that although they absolutely do not replace ultrasound and they're not as accurate as ultrasound, they can be really helpful for increasing our index of suspicion and therefore helping to sort of signpost or funnel those dogs that are most appropriate to have a cardiac ultrasound towards that definitive test. So we're increasing the level of suspicion and evidence that we have that there may be something going on, and that can also be really helpful for convincing owners that this, you know, ultrasound really is a test that we need to consider, even though there is a cost implication to that. So we can use these more available, less expensive tests just to help with the screening process and decide if a dog really is eligible for or is suitable to have a cardiac ultrasound. So thoracic radiography is widely available in most practices, and it can be a useful tool for looking for dogs with heart enlargement that we suspect have early or asymptomatic DCM. A VHS or vertebral heart scale of greater than 10.7 would be considered abnormal, but I think as we all know, thoracic radiography can be really, it's not always very straightforward to interpret heart size, and there's a lot to do with chest conformation, obviously positioning, phase of respiration, breed, you know, lots and lots of things can confound whether it's a straightforward diagnosis of is the heart big or not. Now, obviously, if the heart's already very enlarged, like the ultrasound images that I showed you of that dog that had asymptomatic DCM but already had a very enlarged, poorly contracting heart on ultrasound, that dog's radiographs would have been, you know, very easy to diagnose too. He would have had a large globoid heart. But there are many dogs, particularly these very deep-chested dogs like the Doberman, like the Boxer, where diagnosing subtle heart enlargement associated with asymptomatic DCM can be really challenging. And it's really important to also remember that some breeds of dogs will normally have a VHS value that would suggest cardiomegaly using the original cutoff of greater than 10.7. And that's why we really need breed-specific values for VHF, And some of these breed-specific VHS ranges have been published for a number of breeds, and I've included two here that would be dogs that we do see with dilated cardiomyopathy. Some of the other dogs that have breed-specific VHS ranges are smaller breed dogs that we don't typically see with DCM. So I've picked these two out because we do see these dogs with DCM. And one is the Boxer, and you can see here that the Boxer's normal VHS range actually would be considered cardiomegaly in another breed. 10.8 is already outside of the normal range for other dogs. So 10.8 to 12.4 is what's considered normal for a Boxer. And the way that these ranges are developed is that these are dogs that will have normal heart ultrasounds. And it's all to do with their thoracic shape, but also the ratio between the vertebrae and the sternebrae on which the VHS was first developed. So not all dogs will have sort of standard sized vertebrae, and therefore when you're using these types of scales, they're not going to be necessarily sort of transferable, if you like, across all breeds of dogs that are very phenotypically different. The Labrador is another one that on thoracic radiographs may appear to have an enlarged heart. So 10.2 to 11.4, again, 10.2 would be considered within the normal range for other breeds, but there's definitely a crossover there into what we would typically consider cardiomegaly, but which we know is actually within normal for a Labrador. Now, obviously, if you've got a Boxer or a Labrador that's within these normal or sort of breed-specific normal ranges, so cardiomegaly for other breeds, yet there is a high index of suspicion that there is something else going on, so you've picked up an arrhythmia or a murmur, this doesn't mean that you wouldn't go ahead and do ultrasound, but it's just to be aware that if everything else is pointing towards the fact this dog does not have underlying heart disease apart from the VHS, just do be aware that there are specific breeds that tend to have slightly bigger hearts on thoracic radiographs. So, as we said, the heart size interpretation can be confounded by deep chest conformation of many of these large and giant breeds that are at risk. And do remember that radiographs only show us the sort of outside silhouette of the heart. They don't allow us to look at the individual chambers in a lot of detail, and they certainly don't give us any information about heart muscle function. So that's the key thing that we don't get from radiographs that we do get from echocardiography, and that's the ability to assess systolic function. And remember, systolic failure is one of the hallmarks of DCM, and that's why echo is the gold standard. And this is probably something you're familiar with, but just to run through again how to measure VHS from a thoracic radiograph. So we typically would take a lateral thoracic radiograph, and you're going to measure the long and short axis. So if we measure the long axis, which would be from the carina to the apex, and that length, you're going to count the number of vertebrae, thoracic vertebrae, in that length measurement starting from the cranial edge of T4, and you'll count the number of vertebrae within that length measurement. And in this dog's case, it's 5.2 vertebrae. And then we do the same for the short axis, so we measure along the sort of widest point of the cardiac silhouette. We want to be at just below the caudal vena cava and at right angles to our long axis measurement. And again, we're going to measure from the cranial edge of T4 the number of vertebrae in that short axis or width measurement. Then we add those together, so the length and the width measurements, and we get a VHS. And in this dog's example here, it's 10.2, which is within the normal range. And this show just shows an example of the sort of range of what we see in asymptomatic dilated cardiomyopathy. It can be very early, and therefore very difficult to detect on thoracic radiographs, such as on the left of the screen. This is a Doberman that had echo evidence of systolic failure, so decreased systolic function on echo. But as you can see on thoracic radiographs, there's minimal heart enlargement, if any, sort of evident on thoracic radiography. And yet, on the right of the screen, this is a dog who's still asymptomatic, but in the more sort of advanced stages of asymptomatic DCM. And clearly, we've got a much larger heart here that, you know, no one's going to have any difficulty diagnosing cardiomegaly and recommending an echo if you see those thoracic radiographs. So it just goes to show there's a real range there to consider. And so if one of your screening tests is negative, but you still have a very high index of suspicion, you should proceed to another screening test. Now, ECG is an important screening test, particularly for certain breeds. It may be less revealing in some breeds that don't tend to get arrhythmias associated with their DCM. And so the Cocker Spaniel, we don't see a lot of arrhythmias in those dogs when they get DCM. The Newfoundland, we might see some atrial fibrillation, but they're not a breed where we would be highly suspecting to see arrhythmias. There are breeds that are much more prone to arrhythmias with their dilated cardiomyopathy. And in those breeds, ECG is very important. So a five-minute clinic ECG is a really valuable screening tool. Most vet practices will have access to an ECG machine. And even if you're not confident interpreting the ECG, there are lots of telemedicine type services that can help you with your ECG interpretation if needed. So don't let that put you off taking an ECG, even if you're not always sure how to interpret it. You can seek help to interpret your ECG. So the significance of different types of arrhythmias will be somewhat based on the breed that we see these in. So atrial fibrillation we see frequently during the asymptomatic phase of DCM, particularly in wolfhounds, Irish wolfhounds. Ventricular tachyarrhythmias, so VPCs, ventricular tachycardia, are much more common to see in the preclinical stage of DCM in Dobermans and Great Danes. In those two breeds, there's also a risk of sudden cardiac death before they even develop any symptoms of heart failure. So in that symptom-free phase, when they are asymptomatic, these dogs can get sudden death as their very first sign of having any underlying heart disease, as we talked about before. And certainly if you talk to Doberman breeders and people who have owned Dobermans or many Dobermans through their lifetime, it's not uncommon to come across stories of Dobermans just dropping dead. And prior to that, everyone thought they were completely healthy. And the same with the Great Danes. And it's thought that somewhere between 25 and 30% of Dobermans who have a cult, or cult's another word that you'll sometimes see used for asymptomatic or preclinical DCM, will have sudden death, probably from ventricular tachycardia, and before they ever show any symptoms of congestive heart failure. So if we look at a few ECG examples here, so atrial fibrillation is one of the most common arrhythmias we see in practice, and this is characterized by upright, reasonably narrow-looking QRS complexes that are relatively normal-looking in themselves, but they don't have an obvious P wave preceding them, so that's really key. And here you can see we've got this undulating or wavy baseline where we might look for a P normally, and those are little F waves. And then we also have an irregular rhythm, meaning that the distance between the R waves, so here's an R wave here, and an R wave, and an R wave. If you look at the distance between the R waves, it's variable. VPCs, which as I said, more common in the Dobermans and the Great Danes, These would be wide bazaar complexes, so I've highlighted those there with the red arrows. The actual sinus complexes are these, the smaller ones. So you've got a P wave, QRS complex, T wave, P wave, QRS complex, T wave. Same here, P, QRS, T. And then we have two wide and bazaar complexes, and these are premature because they occur with a shorter R to R interval, okay, than the preceding sinus, excuse me, sinus R to R interval. And they don't have a P wave in front of them. This is the T wave of the preceding QRS complex. There's no obvious P wave here. This is the T wave of the preceding QRS complex. And they look very different from the underlying sinus complexes. So those are VPCs. And then if you have lots of VPCs strung together, that's what we call ventricular tachycardia. And here you can see this dog has lots and lots of VPCs. So this is these are runs of ventricular tachycardia here. The actual rate varies. So these are very fast. See how these are occurring almost with no baseline between them. So you've got a they're basically one ends and another one begins. So this is called R on T phenomenon, which means that this is very high risk when you see that type of rapid ventricular tachycardia, very high risk for degenerating into ventricular fibrillation and potentially associated with sudden death in breeds such as the Doberman and the Great Dane, also in the Boxer. And sometimes those VPCs or the runs of ventricular tachycardia slow down a little bit and we get a little bit of baseline between them. So this is not R on T, but when it gets very fast again, this does show R on T. And occasionally you've got a sinus beat that just interrupts the ventricular tachycardia. And the paper that I mentioned to you earlier about the ESVC screening guidelines for asymptomatic DCM in the Doberman mentions or talks about the 5-minute ECG being very important in Dobermans. If we see one VPC in 5 minutes or longer, or atrial fibrillation, both are considered abnormal and warrant further investigations for underlying DCM, which would include Holter monitoring and echo. And I would say from personal experience, seeing atrial fibrillation in an asymptomatic Doberman would be extremely rare. I don't think I've ever seen that. Atrial fibrillation in Dobermans is uncommon, and when we do see it, it's typically associated with congestive heart failure, and those dogs are they have a very, very poor prognosis. But in the asymptomatic Dobermans, it's these single VPCs that can often either be missed or people think, oh, it's just a single arrhythmia or a single VPC. I'm not overly concerned. But in a Doberman, definitely you want to be concerned. Even if it's a single VPC, you think, I'm not sure if that's baseline artifact, double check, because if it is a single VPC, you'd be surprised what you might find if you placed a Holter on that dog or did an echo. And it is very important because we know that some of these breeds, like the Doberman, if they have an elective anesthetic, for example, in their pre-clinical or asymptomatic phase, the anesthetic can actually accelerate progression of the underlying DCM. So a dog who was in the asymptomatic phase can then more rapidly go into the symptomatic or congestive heart failure phase because of that anesthesia. So if you've got Dobermans coming in for elective procedures, do screen them for DCM first. Now, Holter monitoring is just a way of monitoring heart rhythm for a longer period of time. So we can do this for 24 hours, 48 hours. You can Holter a dog if it'll tolerate wearing the monitor for up to a week. But it gives us a lot more information about the true frequency and severity of the cardiac arrhythmias, which can vary quite a lot from what we see on a short clinic ECG. And it's certainly the preferred screening tool for breeds such as the Doberman, which is prone to life-threatening ventricular arrhythmias in that asymptomatic phase. And again, this ESVC paper talks about Holter monitoring and the criteria that we're looking for. And They say that less than 50 single VPCs, so those are VPCs just occurring on their own as single complexes in a 24-hour period, would be considered normal in Dobermans. I mean, to be fair, I don't think any cardiologist would feel that a single VPC in a Doberman is probably normal, but I think it's more that we would sort of watch and wait and not jump in to do anything at that point. However, more than 300 VPCs in a 24-hour period or two subsequent recordings within a 12-month period showing between 50 and 300 VPCs in 24 hours is considered diagnostic of asymptomatic DCM in Dobermans, regardless of what the echo looks like. So it's another reason we ought to be thinking about Holtering these dogs as a screening test. And often you may find the ventricular arrhythmias before we find much on echo. So it may be even an earlier finding to help us detect these Dobermans even earlier. And this is a little excerpt of what a Holter can look like. This is a Doberman that had asymptomatic DCM. And you can see a few normal beats in here. In the background here, you can see a few normal sinus beats. But we're seeing huge runs of R on T, ventricular tachycardia. And this dog was actually not symptomatic. And that's because although the VTAC was very fast, it didn't last for long enough to probably affect cardiac output significantly. So the dog was able to cope with that. So you'd be surprised what you find on some of these Holter monitors. Holter monitors are expensive to buy, and interpreting the data is quite it requires training and expertise, but there are a number of commercial companies that will loan out Holter units and then interpret the results for you. And this obviously makes Holter monitoring as a screening tool for you to use in your patients who you suspect might have asymptomatic DCM much more accessible in general practice. They're reasonably straightforward to put on, and the Holter companies would provide instructions of how to place them. And then the dogs would typically wear a jacket, so all the Holter monitor is protected behind the jacket because you do want the dog to exercise. And then the owner would keep a 24-hour diary to say what the dog was doing. And then obviously if we see arrhythmias or certain events, we can link that up to what the dog was doing at the time. Probably the other screening test I wanted to mention were biomarkers. They're not standalone tests to replace echocardiography or Holter, but they can be useful additional tests. And the two that you're most likely to be aware of will be N-terminal proBNP. This is brain natriuretic peptide, and it's secreted by the ventricular muscle when the heart stretches. And the other one is cardiac troponin I, and this is a marker of heart muscle cell damage. But again, just like we've talked about with the echo and the thoracic radiographs, you know, it's becoming more and more apparent that we really need to develop breed-specific reference ranges rather than assume that all dogs will have the same BNP values and troponin values. That doesn't appear to be the case. So this is why I'm going to talk about Dobermans here rather than sort of all dogs in general, simply because we know that DCM is so prevalent in the Dobermans, quite a lot of work has been done looking at biomarkers as a way of detecting preclinical or asymptomatic DCM in this specific breed. And there are a number of references here you might want to look up. It's been shown that NT-proBNP is a biomarker that can be used to detect preclinical DCM in Dobermans. You can combine using biomarkers and Holters to increase your index of suspicion, again, in asymptomatic Dobermans. Both sort of standard CTNI or cardiac troponin and high sensitivity cardiac troponin has been shown to be a useful test, again, for asymptomatic DCM in this breed. And those ESVC guidelines that I mentioned before actually have some cutoff values there, which can be quite helpful. But remember, those are specific to the Doberman and not necessarily the same cutoffs we might use in other breeds as we get more information in other breeds. So as we said before, the preclinical period is much longer than the symptomatic phase of the disease, and therefore any treatment that could prolong that preclinical period, so that part of the iceberg that we don't normally see, could actually have a major impact on the quality and the longevity of life in these dogs with DCM. And that was the rationale behind the PROTECT study. So we knew that pimobendan, which is a drug that increases systolic function, it's a calcium sensitizer, that had been shown to significantly reduce mortality and morbidity in Dobermans with congestive heart failure from DCM. But we didn't know at the time that the PROTECT study was first launched, we didn't know at that time whether it would have any benefit on these dogs if we started it earlier in the disease. So this is a study that, if you haven't read, it's certainly worth being familiar with, because the results are really pivotal now in how we approach preclinical DCM in dogs, not just the Doberman, but actually many breeds of dogs. And the PROTECT study was the efficacy, looking at the efficacy of pimobendan in the prevention of both congestive heart failure and sudden death in Dobermans with preclinical DCM. And what we showed in this study was that the dogs in the pimobendan group, which were these ones here, had a much longer symptom-free phase of the disease. You can see 718 days versus dogs that were just on placebo. So these were dogs that were on nothing. They were not receiving pimobendan. Because remember, in the preclinical phase, up until then, we never prescribed any drugs because we didn't have any evidence that anything would help. So it was really, okay, we've made the diagnosis, now we're just going to watch and see when you go into heart failure. So this trial compared pimobendan to dogs on nothing, on placebo. And significantly, or there was a significant benefit of being on pimobendan shown in this study. And so if you take those results and you sort of say, what does that mean for us, you know, treating Dobermans in practice? Well, basically what it means is that the study results showed that pimobendan given to Dobermans that have asymptomatic DCM leads to a prolongation by an average of 9 months more of asymptomatic, so symptom-free, time. So that's delaying the onset of congestive heart failure or sudden death in these dogs by an average of 9 months, and that's really significant. It may not sound like a huge amount of time, but Dobermans get a very aggressive form of DCM, so 9 months for that breed of asymptomatic time, so that's, you know, they have no symptoms of congestive heart failure or anything like that, is really good quality life. And that's why it's really important we find these dogs, because unfortunately if they have the disease they will die of it, so we need to find them early and intervene with treatment. It also, the study also showed that giving pimobendan improved or resulted in a prolongation of the time to death from all causes, so the survival was also improved. It was also safe, so we worry about arrhythmias in this breed, and it certainly did not make the arrhythmias worse, and it wasn't associated with any increase in sudden death. And it's a very important study because it's the first study that showed that, or first cardiology study, that really showed a clinical benefit of using any drug in that preclinical phase of disease, and also showed a real benefit for cardiac screening. As I said before, we'd go looking for these dogs, but we didn't know what to do once we found that they had the disease. Now, not only do we know we need to screen, but now we actually have something that we can do to intervene treatment-wise. So the outcome was that pimobendan is now a licensed treatment for DCM in the preclinical stage of dilated cardiomyopathy in the Doberman. And this is the diagnosis is made by echocardiography, so they would have echo evidence of an enlarged left ventricular end systolic and end diastolic diameter. And it's standard dose, so the standard dose you would give if that dog was in heart failure, so the sort of standard label dose. The big question that I just want to mention before we finish, you know, is what does the PROTECT study, what does that mean for other breeds? Because obviously that study looked at Dobermans, and the reason it looked at Dobermans is they have a very well-defined form of the disease. It's aggressive, so they tend to die, unfortunately, within a certain time frame, so the study would not be open-ended. There was a good chance enough results would be gathered to enable something significant to be found. Whereas if you look at some of these other breeds and enroll them in a study, some of them, you know, have a very good prognosis for DCM. So the Cocker Spaniel tends to live, you know, a reasonable amount of time, you know, years, same with the Irish Wolfhound. So it's more difficult to do a sort of general prospective study looking at drugs in the preclinical phase of the disease, because it's very variable in length between these different breeds. However, one of the things that was noticed in the PROTECT study, and this is one of the reasons why we think it benefits the Dobermans, may not be specific to the Doberman breed per se. What was noticed was that the dogs that received pimobendan, their hearts got smaller. So there's a very good rationale for thinking, well, that's probably not just a benefit that Dobermans would have in the preclinical phase, that benefit is likely to be seen in other breeds too. So if that's the case, then there's a good reason to think it may have a similar benefit in other breeds with asymptomatic DCM. In an ideal world, we would do PROTECT 2, so it would be another prospective randomized clinical trial, and you would enroll all non-Doberman breeds with asymptomatic DCM and follow the exact same protocols as the PROTECT study. However, it would last for years and years and years because some of these dogs have very long preclinical periods, and it would be extremely expensive and difficult because you'd probably have a lot of dropout of patients and difficulty following patients up over that amount of time. It's just not feasible. So what's actually been done instead is a retrospective case control study has been designed called the SHIELD study. And the SHIELD study is looking at the effect of pimobendan in delaying the onset of heart failure in every large breed dog with preclinical DCM. That's what the name means. And so what this study has done is it's looking at the time to onset of heart failure or presumably sudden cardiac death in non-Doberman breeds that have been diagnosed with heart ultrasound as having preclinical or asymptomatic DCM. And it's looking or it's comparing those dogs that receive pimobendan as part of their treatment in the asymptomatic stage against those matched controls, that'd be age and breed matched controls that did not receive pimobendan. And it will also look at the overall survival and adverse events, so any side effects of the drug that was reported in those two treatment groups, and also look at whether their hearts did get smaller and whether that conferred the same apparent benefit that it did in the Dobermans. Sorry. So those results, unfortunately, are not available yet, but they should be available, I'm hoping, either late this year or next year. So hopefully we will have those results. In the meantime, many of us would still use pimobendan in these other breeds, but it's always, you know, best veterinary medicine is evidence-based medicine. So the more evidence that we have to support our treatment choices, the better. So really, we do need these results, but they are being analysed. So all the cases have been already recruited, and the results are being analysed. So hopefully, it shouldn't be too long. So last few slides. So, as we said before, with Holter monitoring, this gives us a lot of information about heart rhythm problems. But if we find heart rhythms, what do we do? Well, obviously, if there are heart rhythm issues that we feel need to be addressed because they potentially are affecting cardiac output and potentially increasing the risk of sudden death in that animal, we will need to think about antiarrhythmic therapy in that symptom-free phase. So The other thing to say about antiarrhythmics is we can't really just say, because you're a Doberman, you've probably got VPCs, therefore we will use this drug. And because you're a Wolfhound, you've probably got atrial fibrillation, therefore we'll use this drug. Because there are dogs who don't do what you expect in terms of the tight serotonin you see on their halter, and we can do a lot of damage using inappropriate drugs. So we do need to have that halter information. And ideally, you'd have halter monitoring as a baseline before giving antiarrhythmics, and then you would perform repeat halter monitoring about 2 to 3 weeks later to assess how efficacious the antiarrhythmic therapy had been. And ideally, you're looking for a greater than 80% decrease in the total number, for example, of VPCs in a 24-hour period. So a huge number of, or a huge decrease, and that's because we know on a day-to-day basis there's a lot of variation. We're also looking for a significant decrease in the arrhythmia complexity. So if we had a lot of runs of ventricular tachycardia, we'd hope to see many shorter runs rather than longer runs, or less frequent runs, I should say. And we'd be happier if, rather than runs, they just had single VPCs. So that's why we're trying to make it less complex, and obviously reduce the total amount of ventricular ectopy. And if it's atrial fibrillation, often we won't convert it to a normal sinus rhythm, but we're looking to slow the rate and control the overall heart rate that the dog has. So that we can improve hemodynamics, as we said, as a goal, to decrease the risk of sudden death. And those would be, you know, real benefits of treatment. But we don't just jump into using treatment unless we are sure that the arrhythmia is compromising the hemodynamics. So either the heart rate is too fast or too slow. Or is it a malignant arrhythmia that we think could degenerate into, for example, ventricular fibrillation and sudden death, like the very rapid ventricular tachycardia with RNT that I showed you earlier? And do remember that any antiarrhythmic drug can be proarrhythmic and have side effects. So that's why repeat Holter monitoring is extremely important after you've started treatment, and for follow-up, you know, maybe every 6 to 12 months, just to see how well the treatment is working, and it may need to be changed over time. So in summary, take-home messages. An increased awareness of at-risk dogs, so those are dogs who, you know, have the breed predispositions, will help ensure early detection of preclinical DCM. Screening is an important way to detect affected dogs. Gold standard is echo for screening, plus or minus Holter. But biomarkers can be used to pre-screen dogs, and the Doberman is one breed that biomarkers have been shown to be effective screening tools, but they do not replace echo and Holter. You'd still be looking to do those as a follow-up to the biomarkers, but they can at least help you select appropriate dogs. So you might want to do your biomarkers, so cardiac troponin or BNP, on a yearly basis to get some baselines in those dogs, and then obviously if they started to increase, that would give you increased confidence to sort of say to the owners, I really think we need to screen your dog with Holter, potentially echo for asymptomatic DCM. As we said, definitive diagnosis and staging with echocardiography is really important, and particularly important if we're thinking of starting preclinical therapy, because for the Doberman, the PROTECT study criteria need to be met. So the heart has to be big on echo if we're going to actually start pimobendan. Just because you're a Doberman, we don't start pimobendan. You have to have echo evidence of an enlarged heart to meet those criteria. So thank you very much for your attention. Sorry we've overrun by a few minutes, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions if anyone has any. So I've actually got a couple that have come through here. One of the questions, a really good question, one of you has written, I have an Irish Wolfhound patient and it has atrial fibrillation on its ECG. It had an echo, and the echo was normal. What should we advise? So in an Irish Wolfhound, which is an increased or it's an at-risk breed for dilated cardiomyopathy, some of these dogs will have atrial fibrillation as the very first sign that they have DCM. And we think, we don't know for sure, but we think what happens is that as the heart muscle disease is developing, atrial fibrillation can be triggered, even if the ultrasound looks normal at that stage. The key things to do for that dog would be to keep a close eye on it. If the atrial fibrillation rate is slow, so it's what we call low atrial fibrillation, so the rate is actually quite close to the sinus, normal sinus rate, you wouldn't even need to necessarily start any antiarrhythmic treatment. If the atrial fibrillation rate starts to rise, we would typically start therapy to control the atrial fibrillation rate. And that dog would need to be having probably 6 monthly, certainly no more or no less frequently than 12 monthly echo and Holter rechecks, just to monitor that dog and see how quickly it was progressing. But there is a very good chance, the owners ought to be aware of this, that even if the echo is normal now, it does not mean that the echo will remain normal. And over time, depending on the age of the dog and how quickly the underlying disease will progress, that heart may start to enlarge on echocardiography, and therefore therapy in that preclinical phase to support systolic function may be indicated. And there is a study that was designed differently from the PROTECT study, actually, but did show a benefit of using pimobendan in the preclinical phase of Irish Wolfhounds 2. Now, it wasn't looked at against placebo. It was looked at against certain other drugs. And the Wolfhound will be included in the SHIELD study to sort of verify those results. But I think based on the publication that is there, there would be enough evidence to say that if your Wolfhound's heart did start to dilate, then pimobendan would be indicated for that dog. The other question I've got here is about, you haven't mentioned diets. Is diet an important consideration for dogs with dilated cardiomyopathy as a potential cause? Yes, that's a very good question. There is some interest at the moment, or some diet is receiving some publicity, as some unusual breeds have been reported as having been diagnosed with DCM, and these are dog breeds that we really wouldn't normally associate with having DCM. And actually, a careful diet history has shown that some of these are on these sort of designer diets, sort of grain-free diets. We don't really know what the direct link or the exact link in these diets is, and what it is, whether it's something they're eating or something they're not getting in the diet, that's causing this sort of dilated cardiomyopathy phenotype. But it does tend to be reversible, that if they're then put onto a normal diet, a balanced diet, a sort of more typically commercially available diet, the heart will often improve, so it'll remodel and become much more normal. And if they have developed congestive heart failure from a nutritional related cardiomyopathy, you do need to support that with standard drugs, but as the heart remodels, which is often the case, you may be able to get them off those drugs. Those congestive heart failure drugs are always question your owners about diet history in these dogs. Make sure they're not on a vegan or vegetarian or these sort of designer sort of like lentil and kangaroo type diets. As I said, we don't know exactly which ingredients or lack of ingredients at the moment currently are causing some of these problems. Traditionally, it was sort of a taurine or potentially some people thought carnitine deficiency. That doesn't appear to be the current issue that's going on with some of these diets, but definitely an important consideration when you're talking to your clients. Okay, so I think that's everything. I've got one other that's come through just now. Do I have preferred antiarrhythmics? That is it's a good question. It's very dependent on the type of arrhythmia. So if you have, for example, a dog who's got atrial fibrillation and you want to slow the rate, you have a choice of drugs to use. So you could use digoxin, diltiazem, a beta blocker like atenolol. When you are deciding how best to treat that dog, you really need to know how well the heart muscle is contracting, and are there any other concurrent arrhythmias in that specific case I've just given you. So, for example, let's say we have a dog with atrial fibrillation and on echo he's got very poor systolic function. I would be worried about using a beta blocker in him because systolic or beta blockers will decrease systolic function. So will calcium channel blockers like diltiazem, but probably to a lesser extent. Hopefully, if you've got pimavendin on board as well, that can help to support systolic function, but I'd still be a bit concerned about using a beta blocker without knowing how good the systolic function was. Digoxin could be used in that situation as that has a mild positive inotropic effect, so supports systolic function. But if your dog also has concurrent VPCs scattered through his Holter or ECG, digoxin can make ventricular arrhythmias worse. So this is why Holter, so clinic ECG is really important, but a Holter in any dog that you're considering antiarrhythmic therapy on is really important if you can. I know it's not always feasible financially or logistically, but if you can, it really is the preferred way of getting this information so you can pick the right antiarrhythmic. And again, with ventricular arrhythmias, our standard sort of go-to is often sotalol, but we see dogs in which sotalol is pro-arrhythmic. Their arrhythmias get worse with sotalol. So it wouldn't always be the best choice. So again, by doing baseline and then following up, you know whether you've picked the right one. So I think that's it. Thank you again, everybody. Really appreciate your attention.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Nuala for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.